which is intended for is sort of a little bit more of an advanced, more technical conference that's in some senses narrower in scope. It deals primarily with technical economic theory. In past years, we've used Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State as the textbook, going through the entire book chapter by chapter. The Mises University is a bit more broad and diverse. There's economic theory, of course, but also political economy, political theory, history, philosophy, culture, and so on. And is designed not only for experienced students, but also for newcomers to the Austrian tradition. So if you can attend either or both the conferences next summer, I would strongly urge you to do so. I'll actually be giving a talk later this week. I think it's actually tomorrow, here at the Mises U on some of the legal and political issues that we talked about on Tuesday. In fact, I saw on the discussion threads that a few of you have been watching some of the courses. Oh, darn it, I forgot to record. Sorry. Okay, now we're recording. Weren't those hilarious jokes I just told? I'm sorry those of you who are watching the recording missed them. And now that we've gone over all of the answers for the final exam, it's time to start recording. No, I'm only kidding, of course. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, Mises University. Some of you have been watching the live stream. darn it, Dean, you caught me. Some of you have been watching the live stream, which is not a perfect substitute, but at least a partial substitute for being here in person. I've very much enjoyed the talks that I've given, and really, what I've been doing here at Mises U is giving some talks that are, you know, on the subjects that we're covering in our course. So really abbreviated versions of the topics that we've been doing this semester. So, excuse me, probably nothing new for you guys. At least my lectures here at Mises University are nothing new for you guys, though you might hear some material presented in a more condensed form. So I did a 1 hour survey of entrepreneurship, a 1 hour survey on production theory and the theory of the firm. And tomorrow we'll be doing a 1 hour survey on the corporation as a legal form and some of the political and sort of tax issues associated with the corporations and with the corporation. I'm also doing one on Saturday that you might enjoy that's on material that's not in our course on the economics of networks, specifically innovation and new technology, a lot of applications to the internet, intellectual property, and other issues, applications of Austrian economics to network and technology issues. I think that would actually be a fun Mises Academy course to do, to maybe stretch that out into an entire semester. one of the areas of entrepreneurship theory that we haven't covered much this semester, because I don't really go into much detail about it in the book, is the entrepreneurship approach associated with Joseph Schumpeter. So, you know, part of my whole shtick is that the Schumpeterian approach to innovation lies a little bit outside the theory of entrepreneurship proper. So Schumpeter's approach to entrepreneurship is not really part of the Misesian capitalist entrepreneur, you know, program. But that, of course, doesn't mean it isn't important, and that it isn't worth studying, and that it isn't insightful, and in many ways true. I'd love to do another Mises Academy course just on innovation, starting with Schumpeter and other scholars. There's a lot of great current research that's being done. There are a lot of important applications of Austrian theory to research and development, to the organization of technology, intellectual property, the patent system, effects of innovation on the economy, how firms organize themselves to be innovative, how discovery processes are coordinated, the relationship between basic science and applied research. I think it's a fascinating area and one that I would love to learn more about and to talk to you guys about. But again, that would have to be the subject for another course. So be sure and lobby your Mises Academy administrators to have some new courses added, including maybe that one. So, anyway, what's on your mind today, guys? what's new, what's different, what's interesting, what's important. Okay, Dean has a question about horizon problems. Dean, I think you've expressed it exactly in the right way. Let me generalize just a little bit. Right, the basic problem with patron-owned organizations and other organizations in which equity ownership is tied to some other relationship with the firm is that the ownership shares are less liquid, right? And so those who own those equity shares are making decisions in their capacity as owners while also thinking about what's in their interest in these other capacities, right? So if you have a worker-owned co-op, right, when the workers are making decisions about governance and operations and so on, you know, their interest as an employee, as a wage-earning employee, could be in conflict with their interest as an equity holder, as an owner, right? And so it's this sort of conflict of interest within individuals, because they all wear multiple hats, that causes some of these incentive conflicts. You know, the advantage of the investor-owned company relative to the patron-owned firm is precisely that you have the separation of the ownership interest from the other interests. So equity holders can make decisions, can vote, and so on, purely on the basis of their interest as equity holders. And it's very easy for them to adjust their portfolios, right? So if you know you're interested in long-term returns, a particular firm is interested in generating dividends in the present. If that dividend policy is not in line with your own investment, sell your stock. You just walk away. You just exit, right? If it's a co-op, you know, a worker-owned co-op, to exit, you have to quit your job. Right, if it's a farmer-owned facility, to exit, you have to stop delivering corn to the ethanol plant and find someplace else to buy your corn, and that's an entirely different thing. So owners different places in their investment, in their life cycle, in terms of their incentive. Well, younger patron owners might want the firm to reinvest all its excess, all its free cash, and not pay a dividend. Older owners who want to cash out, you're a year or two away from retirement working for the firm, you want to cash out, you want, you don't care as much about capital gains, you want dividends. It's very difficult to resolve those conflicts when everyone, with decision authority, also has this employment relationship with the firm. So, the point is, Dean, within any organization with multiple owners, you have the possibility of different interests based on different investment horizons. But if the shares are liquid, if it's easy to enter or to exit by simply buying and selling stock, then those issues don't cause a problem for the governance of the firm. It's only when you're tied to the firm, your shares are not liquid because you have this other relationship, that these horizon problems come to the fore, and that they cause conflict and slow down decision, make decision processes very slow, and so on. Once again, to be clear, we're engaged in this kind of meaning always trying to weigh the advantages and disadvantages of various. Various kinds of organizations, and many people between one's interest in the firm as an equity owner and one's interest in the firm in some deeper, more fundamental way is bad, right? That causes principal-agent problems, the Burley and Means separation of ownership and control, blah 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 blah. So to have the shareholders also be workers, or also be managers, or also be customers, or also be suppliers, it is argued, alleviates the principal agent problem. And that could very well be true. The point here is simply that you have to weigh that against, or balance that against, the possible horizon problem, portfolio problem, and so on. These other problems associated with the non-tradability of the shares. So it's six of one, half a dozen the other, right? There are always there are always benefits and costs associated with any organizational form, and it's up to market participants to kind of try to sort that out on a case-by-case basis.
Okay,
Dean, I hope that makes sense. If you're going to learn about papers written by some specialists and cooperatives and firms, one of my colleagues at Missouri, Mike Cook, has written quite a lot about this, and you might click on some of the links on the blog. The research that he's done on the so-called vaguely defined or ill-defined property rights. Other issues, questions, problems. She has us, it looks like. Hopefully she's just having maybe a technical problem and we'll log back on rather than being so deeply offended by something that by one of David Gordon's jokes that she had to run. Anything else? Okay, whoops. Dean, I almost never read more than the headlines in the comics in my goofy local paper. I like to read the wedding announcements, too. Today, two headlines caught my eye. The first, environmentalists, loggers push new wilderness deal in northwest Washington. Upshot, tens of thousands more acres of untouchable wilderness. Yeah, I would imagine that owners of rival logging tracts would be very, very happy about this. Marriage between woolly headedness and sinister interests. Yeah, it's pretty funny. There's, you know, in the environmental literature, there are a lot of examples of kind of the perverse incentives that these kinds of environmental policies bring about. You know, declaring entire tracts to be untouchable, even things for species preservation. There's what some people in the movement call the, let's see, it's the three S's. It's a shoot, shovel, and shut up. So the idea is the way the Endangered Species Act works is that, let's say you own some timber, you own some forest land that you're going to harvest for timber. If you discover, you know, a baby spotted owl or something, you know, you would think that sort of common sense would tell you, oh, well, you want to take this baby owl and take it to the zoo or give it to the Sierra Club or someone who can take care of it, make sure it's nurtured, it protected. You know, maybe it's injured. You want to nurse it back to health, and you want to let everyone know, look, I found this baby spotted owl. Let's do what we can to help it. But of course, if you do that, if the government finds out that the baby tree is on your property, of course, then they'll declare your entire tract of land to be untouchable wilderness. So, perversely, your incentive, if you discover, you know, an endangered species, some kind of endangered species animal on your property, your incentive is to kill it and to bury it and shut up about it. You know, shoot, shovel, and shut up. Don't let anyone find out that this animal was living on your property. Hence, there's it gives exactly the opposite incentives. If you really cared about taking care of these animals, you'd want to see one that's on your property. If the government's response is to declare all of your property, so then the last is to declare spotted owls or baby seals or snail darters or whatever. I know property owners have an incentive to hide existence of important animals and species. Yeah, interesting about the grizzly bears. I mean, it's funny when you think about this bootleggers and Baptists perspective. Once you have that framework in mind, you begin to see it everywhere, right? In almost lots and lots of cases of different kind of call it do-gooder legislation. It's quite easy once you look beneath the surface to find out, okay, what is the bootlegger interest in all of this? And, you know, it isn't, I'm not claiming that it's sort of a praxeological certainty that there will be a more sinister private interest lurking beneath the surface, but there almost always is. Another one of Yandel's great examples, I can't remember if he mentions it in that particular article, is the meatpacking industry and how the food and Pure Food and Drug Act and the late 19th, early 20th century federal laws regulating health and safety, you know, having safety inspections for meat processing facilities and so on, which everyone thinks, well, of course, that's in the public interest to protect health, right? That this was really attempts by small mom-and-pop butcher shops to put the big industrial meat packers out of business because they were competing with them. Mr. Swift, Augustus Swift in Chicago in particular, who pioneered the use of sort of a centralized slaughtering facility in Chicago and the use of refrigerated railroad cars to deliver fresh meat to consumers, you know, all throughout the Midwest. You know, there was never any evidence of any health or safety issues at the Swift meat processing plants. In fact, they were probably much, much safer and much, much healthier. You know, the plants were much cleaner and the procedures were much better than those in the mom and pop, you know, local butcher shops. But the butcher shops were able to persuade the public and the politicians that in the interest of public health, large meat packing facilities had to be inspected. Of course, mom-and-pop butcher shops were exempt in that kind of legislation. It's very easy to see the bootlegger interest there, but it, you know, it almost never gets talked about. Something from Daniel Hannan here. Grayson, if you have the forward a link, if you have it, there's been, this is a great example, this example of the elephant populations. There were a couple of studies that came out in the 80s, I think, from PERC, the Political Economy Research Center. There was also a piece in maybe the Freeman called something like... which I'm sure you can easily find. There's a lot of good research on this elephant issue. You know, basically, if you want to preserve a natural resource, the best thing to do is to give people private ownership in that resource, right? You know, the knee-jerk do-gooder reaction of banning all trade in ivory, a worldwide ban in ivory trade. I mean, that's the worst thing you could do to try to protect the elephant population. That just creates a black market in ivory, raises the price of ivory. It's like the drug trade, right? Gives poachers an incentive, high financial rewards to engage in ivory, the ivory trade. It's bad for elephant populations. It brings the whole aspect of crime, organized crime, into the picture. It's very much analogous to the drug war, that, you know, giving local villages ownership rights in elephants is the best way to preserve the elephant population, because it's those local owners, property owners, who have an incentive, right, to make sure that the stock of elephants is not, you know, exhausted. As my old friend Dwight Lee used to put it, when we used to teach together, he always came up with an exam question with something like, give the example of some fish or bird that's an endangered species, and then say, okay, but, you know, we slaughter, you know, 200 million chickens a day in the U.S., and yet no one's worried about chickens becoming extinct, right? What's the difference between chickens and elephants, or chickens and, you know, some exotic fish or something that is becoming endangered? Well, it's, of course, because the chickens are owned, right? The chickens are private property. And, of course, chicken farmers are not going to slaughter 100% of the chickens with no eggs left over to hatch the next round of chickens. The chicken population is thriving as never before, even though we kill the darn things like you wouldn't believe, because they're privately owned. Same thing with other natural resources, lakes, rivers, streams, forests, and so on. Signing private property rights is the best way to preserve the quality and sustainability and so on of these natural resources, making them public property, government-owned property, such that no one has an incentive to take proper care of them, is, you know, exactly the worst thing that you could want to do. Oh yeah, okay, but cows versus buffalo is the same thing as chickens. There's a lot of good articles in this area, a lot of good research in this area if you're interested, like, you know, sort of overfishing problems, problems with the whaling industry, that again, by assigning ownership rights to natural resources, you get exactly the result that you would expect. You get preservation and thriving of the stocks of those natural resources. But, you know, it's very counterintuitive to people. So it takes some explanation to kind of walk through. I think the ivory trade and elephant population example, the contrast between between different countries, you know, between Kenya and Zimbabwe or whatever, those can be very informative, very illustrative for people. If you're interested in these kinds of issues, I would recommend the PERC website. Go to PERC.org, and there's lots and lots of articles looking at these kinds of things. Other issues? What else is on your mind? Yeah, okay. Me versus Roderick. Well, I mean, this is a slight oversimplification, but my view is that Roderick and Kevin Carson are mixing two different things. Right, they're mixing a normative argument about, you know, what the state should or should not do with regard to particular organizational forms, with a purely positive prediction or conjecture about what the world would look like in the absence of any of state intervention in corporate size or business organization, size of the firm, and so on. And in my view, those are separable claims, right? So, you know, Roderick and I both agree that there are many state interventions that benefit large firms, that benefit the corporate form, that benefit more hierarchical organizations. Roderick, if you really push him, will admit, okay, there are some interventions that benefit small firms as well, relatively speaking, but those are small and sort of quantitatively insignificant. Well, I mean, look, we agree that it would be better to let market participants sort these things out, and experiment with different organizational forms and different, you know, large and small firms and so on, and sort of figure out what works the best. The area of disagreement is the prediction about what would happen if, in fact, we did that. Or to put it another way, if you look sort of historically, empirically, we disagree about what the net effect of previous government intervention has been. So Roderick and Kevin argue that, you know, the way things are now, the fact that we have lots of large corporations and, you know, hierarchies and so on, is only the result of government net government subsidies. My view is, I don't think we can say for sure. It's an empirical historical question. Right, it's not an a priori truth, but pragmatically, my reading of history and my understanding of the kind of theoretical benefits and costs suggest that, no, I think even if you hadn't had any government interventions that benefited corporations, the landscape wouldn't look too different from the way it looks today. But, you know, again, that's an empirical historical difference. Now, I should point out I'm oversimplifying, because there are some theoretical differences related to property rights theory. I don't know exactly where Roderick stands on this, but I know that Kevin Carson also believes, he has a particular theory of what you call property abandonment, right? So different classical liberal, libertarian scholars have different justifications for private property, and, you know, simplest being some kind of Lockean notion of, you know, mixing your labor with the land, and that therefore appropriating previously unowned land. Question is, what has to happen? When does that land, if you're sort of an absentee owner, does that land eventually revert back to an unowned state? So, there's some disagreement among libertarian scholars on this point. I mean, I think the mainstream position within libertarianism is that, you know, if I, you know, legitimately purchase a piece of land, you know, I own it in perpetuity until I sell it or give it away, or I or my descendants own it in perpetuity, even if I don't ever set foot on it again, right? That I can be an absentee owner of that land once I have acquired it through just means. My ownership rights remain in perpetuity. Kevin, as I understand him, argues that, no, you have to do something, you have to use that land in a certain way to maintain your ownership rights, otherwise it reverts back to an unowned state. Right? I mean, there is a notion of abandonment in lots of different legal theories about property. You know, what you never formally declare, okay, I hereby give this up, but in sort of de facto, you do give it up. You know, a piece of vacant land, it becomes overgrown with weeds. You know, you have no interest in returning there. I mean, at what point does that become appropriable for somebody else? According to Kevin, unless the property owner sort of continually demonstrates that he is using that land in some way, by living there or by managing a factory that's there, it becomes homesteadable by somebody else. And so that's a part of Kevin's argument against the large decentralized organization. Part of his argument in favor of smaller, you know, sort of mom-and-pop stores is that if you run a mom-and-pop store, you obviously demonstrate that you own the store because you're there working at it every day. If you're an absentee owner of a firm, then that kind of ownership is illegitimate in some way. I haven't followed his writing on it closely enough to explain it in much more detail than that. Maybe some others of you have looked at it. But so, leaving that issue aside, it's just an empirical disagreement about the relative magnitude of different kinds of interventions. But let me read part two of your question, Dean. Specifically, I can imagine a scenario in which both of you would happily declare yourselves the winner. Say 50 years after a libertarian society is achieved, and there are lots of sole proprietorships and entities nearly as small, providing various services. In tandem, there are some truly colossal firms producing spacecraft. Well, you'd say, see huge firms. Roderick would say, see more tiny firms. Yes, Dean, you're exactly right. In that case, we would both be, well, I would be happy. I don't know if Roderick, I think Roderick predicts that he just doesn't think that would happen. I suppose if you pushed him, he would say, yes, hypothetically, you know, if that were to happen, he would not complain about it, at least sort of legally, but he doesn't think it's very likely. On the other hand, I mean, I'm enjoying having this conversation, but I'm kind of putting words in Roderick's mouth. I don't know if he's probably in the building somewhere. I should bring him up and put him before the camera, and we could just duke it out now. I think Roderick might also add, I mean, this is something that comes out of in the email exchange, right, that I think Roderick has, there are also some kind of moral, and what I see as kind of aesthetic issues about authority. I think Roderick also views hierarchy, he has some ethical problems with hierarchy, even purely private hierarchy. Whereas my view, I'm ethically neutral on this, at least from a political economy point of view, that if your boss is a jerk, as long as you're free to quit if you don't like it and you voluntarily accepted the job, I don't have any moral problem with that kind of work environment. A well-known business writer is a professor at Stanford named Bob Sutton, with whom I've sparred over the years, has a book called The No Asshole Rule, and he talks about firms perform better when bosses are not assholes, when bosses are nice. Quite frankly, to me, as an economist, it makes no difference whether the boss is an asshole or not, as long as there is no government coercion, right? As long as the boss doesn't have coercive power over the workers. If he treats his workers like, you know, like serfs, well, I mean, some workers might be happy to work in an environment like that, or if the wages are high enough, they're willing to put up with a boss who's a jerk. To me, that's not a libertarian issue whatsoever. I think Roderick sees that it is, and thinks that even, you know, in a pure sort sort of anarcho-capitalist utopia, there would be something wrong, something distasteful, something unsettling about large bureaucratic organizations in which, you know, rich, you know, bosses are sort of being jerks toward and, you know, ordering around lower-level employees. So I think that's a difference as well. So maybe Roderick would say, even if large firms were sort of economically efficient somehow in a free market, they would still be bad. We should still be sort of arguing against them because something about that form of organization is not conducive to the flourishing of human dignity, something like that. I really, you'd have to ask Roderick about it, but I think that's part of the disagreement as well, Dean. Yeah, I mean, look, if the costs of starting a business are lower, more people would start businesses. Yeah, but that's a gross effect, right? If at the same time the costs of expanding existing businesses become lower, then on the margin, you might have fewer new businesses started, right? Because it's in my interest, I'm better off as an individual joining one of these existing firms that's expanding instead of starting my own firm. So, you know, again, if the costs of doing lots of different things all go down, then which of those things you get more of kind of depends on the relative magnitudes, right? Which costs are going down faster, or which costs go down more than which other costs? And again, I don't think there's any way we could say that a priori. Yeah, Grayson, don't go all Latin and Greek on us here. But you know, I I'm not a philosopher. I'm just a simple man. I'm just a slow-witted economist. I don't know about all these deep philosophical issues. So maybe that's part of the disagreement between Roderick and myself as a philosopher and an economist disagreeing. And by the way, just to you know, if you'll allow me to be grumpy for just a moment, one of the reasons that I have found the discussions with Roderick and Kevin Carson and others to be a little bit frustrating is I think those... I think people on the kind of left mutualist side, I think they need to study the economics literature a little bit more closely. That, you know, there's this huge body of literature on organizational design, on the benefits and costs of alternative organizational forms, the incentive effects of hierarchy and so on, that just is really almost completely ignored on the left mutualist side. In my judgment, there's some cherry picking that's going on. And yeah, I mean, if you look in the literature, you can pick an article here and a book here and a study here that shows, you know, all these bad things about hierarchy. Okay, fine. But if you read the literature more widely and look at it in a more balanced fashion, you find that there are pros and cons of all organizational forms. And I find it frustrating that the left mutualist camp does not seem to be reading and reflecting upon and synthesizing and digesting this vast body of literature, mostly ignoring it and just cherry-picking a few studies or a few articles that seem to support their particular point of view. You know, and I think I mentioned this in one of the exchanges. I sort of teased Roderick that, I mean, he's an expert on Aristotle, but, you know, if I wanted to start arguing with Roderick about Aristotle's thought, I think he would expect that I would first master the standard classic literature on Aristotle and not just make up my own stuff. My sense is that the left mutualist side has not mastered Coase and Williamson and Chandler and, you know, all the, you know, sort of standard literature in organizational economics. So, anyway, okay. Oh, so Grayson's added something here too. Okay, Dean, another line of argument which I could have used. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, maybe in the absence of restrictions on international capital flows, maybe you'd have more multinational firms. You know, some of the large U.S. firms might actually be subsidiaries of even larger foreign firms. And by the way, I think the issue of the multinational is extremely interesting and somewhat underexplored by Austrians. A paper that I'm working on now looks at sort of the role of multinationals in not just doing bad things like partnering with the state and lobbying for state privilege, which they do, but also in forming a kind of check on the state, sort of a constraint on state expansion. You probably know, if you've listened to Ralph Rako and others who talk about kind of the rise of the commercial revolution and industrial revolution in Europe. You know, why did Europe advance in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries more rapidly than Asia, Africa, South America, whatever? Part of the explanation, I mean, if you look historically, right, I mean, if you go back far, China had a great civilization, very advanced technologically. India has had great advances in civilization and so on, but the Industrial Revolution happened in Europe, in Western Europe, not in China or in India. Part of the explanation that's typically offered by historians is precisely because Europe was decentralized. In Europe, you had a more fragmented political order with multiple competing, and one extremely important transnational institution, the church, the Roman Church, right? So the fact that there was competition among different authorities, right? That in some sense the Pope, you know, the Pope was above the kings of various lands, and you had disagreements among sovereigns, where the Pope could, the Vatican could exercise some authority to mediate those disagreements and so on. In other ancient civilizations, you know, the Incas and the ancient Hindu civilization and China and so on, you know, the kind of spiritual head of society, the head of the religious order was the king, right? So the head of state was also head of church, and you had a highly unified kind of political structure. And the argument is, you know, where you have a less unified, fragmented political structure with competing authorities, that limits what the authority can do in terms of, you know, appropriating wealth and oppressing citizens and so on. And so this, you know, there were more limitations on state power in the fragmented Western European setting than there were in other places around the world. And that's why the capitalism came to flourish in Europe. You know, if you sort of extend that analogy forward, one argument that's been offered, it's not original to me, is that nowadays transnational institutions such as multinational firms, but also transnational nonprofit agencies, you know, the Red Cross and international foundations, the Gates Foundation, whatever, play a similar role. They also place some check on what national authorities can do. And if you think of multinational enterprise, multinational firms, it's easy to see some of those examples, right? I mean, countries want to attract foreign investment. They want multinationals to have a presence in their country, so they have to make economic conditions attractive for those multinationals. Now, they could do it in a value-destroying way by offering subsidies, you know, bailouts or, you know, some kind of favoritism, whatever, to particular countries, particular companies. But they can also do it by having lower tax rates, by having more secure, you know, less corruption, more secure property rights, and so on. So in a sense, the threat of multinational organizations, the fact that they can threaten to pull resources out of a country very quickly and easily, you know, that's something that the host country doesn't want to allow, right? So multinationals can sort of put pressure on governments to have less onerous labor market regulations and capital market regulations, and to have lower corporate taxes and so on. There are a lot of kind of left-wing critics of the multinational who recognize this and are very alarmed about it. You know, they say, well, multinational companies, you know, they exercise all this power over governments. They're more powerful than governments, and this is horrible. That's why we need to crush multinationals and make governments more powerful. I think, well, gosh, if they're more powerful than governments and they can constrain governments, it's a good thing from the point of view of value creation. Anyway, I have a little Mises.org article on this, but I'm working on expanding it into a research paper. Yeah, that's right, Dean. Same thing with large financial firms, right? That, look, as libertarians, we want a world of kind of divided sovereignties, right? It's if there's any political power at all, it's better that it be separated, fragmented, that it be layered in ways that you have, a system of checks and balances, not the sort of phony checks and balances provided by the U.S. Constitution, where one branch of the federal government is supposed to constrain another branch of the federal government. No, this is much more like, federalism. Maybe some of you have seen Tom Woods's new book on nullification, right? This idea that states can refuse to implement a federal rule. That's the kind of layered authority that I have in mind. And you add multinational corporations on top of national governments, you have an additional layer. Dean, that's right. I mean, I suppose I don't want to push the argument. I want to make sure the argument is nuanced, because one could also add multinational government organizations, World Bank, IMF, whatever, and say, aren't they playing the same role that I'm talking about? I mean, in one sense they are, but the whole point is that large multinationals still have to compete with each other in a market. Right, and they don't, as firms, have the coercive power of the state behind them, though they can partner with states, of course. But IMF, World Bank, as state entities, right, that they do have the power of coercion, on their side. Okay, another issue about Roderick versus Peter. I've suggested that we resolve our differences in the boxing ring, or with some kind of a wrestling match. David Gordon could he could adjudicate, because he's the wrestling expert. He could set it up for us, and it could be some kind of a cage match, maybe duel to the death. What does corporate power really mean? Corporations in libertarian society would be more totally at the mercy of their customers, as opposed to now, where they can call down the awful majesty of the law with a few well-placed bribes. Very, very true. It's not bigness per se, but access to the instruments of coercion. No, I agree completely. I mean, in a purely voluntary society, no matter how large a firm might be, right, it doesn't have power in the sense of, political power. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, in the business literature, I always get nervous when I hear people use, terms like power and, there are all these kind of military or political terms that are imported into the discussions about markets. Mises actually makes this point. I think it's in the Anti-Capitalist Mentality, where he says, people used to call Mr. Hershey, the Chocolate King, or railroad entrepreneurs were called robber barons, right? I mean, a king and a baron, those are political titles, right? And so Mises argued, look, Mr. Hershey, no matter how big he might be, no matter how large a share of the chocolate market his firm might have, he doesn't have any legal right to coerce somebody into buying his chocolate. He can't put a gun to your head and say, buy my chocolate or I pull the trigger, right? So whatever kind of influence Mr. Hershey might have had over chocolate consumers, he was not a king, right? He did not have any political authority in his capacity as a business person, right? Poor Bill Gates, who people love to hate. Bill Gates, never had he never put a gun to anybody's head and say, buy Windows. Okay, I mean, a lot of techie guys. Grayson, I don't know where you stand on this, but you know, a lot of people in the tech sector, it's kind of hip and fashionable to hate Microsoft. And I mean, I guess liking the Mac OS wouldn't be hip enough either. You have to be a Unix man or something like that. I mean, that's fine. You can like any operating system you want, and you can think that Windows products are crap, and that you know, they're designed to appeal to the lowest common denominator, unsophisticated, low-tech consumers. That's fine. Those are personal beliefs that everyone is welcome to, but you know, don't ever think that Bill Gates somehow illegitimately, that he got his large market share for desktop operating systems through some kind of illegitimate means. I mean, he did not have the power of coercion behind him. He could never compel anyone to buy Windows. You say, well, yeah, but aren't you kind of forced to use Microsoft Office and Microsoft Windows because everybody else does, and because that's kind of the standard platform, and if you use Star Office instead of MS Office, then your stuff's not going to be 100% compatible with other people's, blah, blah, blah. Look, I mean, if you want to use the word forced, fine, but it's a qualitatively different concept. You know, I am compelled by market conditions to use product A. Your utility as a consumer is higher when you choose to use Microsoft Windows, even if you don't really like it, but you recognize that other people like it and you want compatibility and so on, then your utility would be if you use Linux or what, you know, any custom operating system of your choice. You're simply making a free and informed decision about what satisfies your preferences, right? There's not one iota of force involved. So it's misleading to use the word force in that context that we often do in kind of everyday language, right? So large firms in a free market setting do not have any power of compulsion, coercion. They cannot force people to do anything. They may have influence, right? They may be able to move the market with their pronouncements. They may be able to set things up so that it is in consumers' interest to use their product rather than somebody else's product. Fine. But again, that's a qualitatively different thing from power in the political sense. Yeah, thanks. Grayson has found some quotes. Yeah, the Chocolate King quote. That's in Human Action. Okay, great. I think he has a similar discussion in Anti-Capitalist Mentality. No, I mean, and Dean, you're exactly right. In our system of political capitalism, firms compete not only in the beneficial ways that we're talking about, but they also compete in less beneficial ways, right? They compete for influence, they compete for political authority, and all the rest of it. And that's a form of competition that we can analyze as scientists, as scholars, as students, right? But from a normative point of view, it's a form of competition that is not value creating, right? But rather is value destroying, sort of a bad kind of entrepreneurship, if you like. I take it that as support for my position, but I mean, I'm sure if we put Roderick in front of the camera, he would maybe interpret it differently. So, anyway, I don't want to make too much. Look, the reason for bringing in these issues and having you read the thing between me and Roderick in class is not to stir up trouble, although stirring up trouble is fun, but just to point out, first to make you aware of this debate in the libertarian literature, that there is a kind of anti-corporation side among libertarians. But also to get you, really to remind you of the point that has been made several times during our course, that, you know, all forms of organization are flawed. All feasible ways to organize economic activity have costs, have drawbacks, relative to other feasible forms of organization. But that simply means that, you know, we would expect in a free market, given 90 and uncertainty, to see a lot of experimentation, a lot of economic change. Maybe we're talking about what would the distribution of firm sizes be in the free market? I mean, it wouldn't be static, right? I mean, maybe today there would be a lot of small mom and pops and not many large corporations, and tomorrow there would be a lot more corporations and fewer mom and pops, and the day after that there'd be more cooperatives and partnerships, and the day after that there would be some new organizational form that we've never even thought of. We would expect to see a lot of experimentation, a lot of variety, a lot of correction, a lot of redoing things. Again, that's one beautiful aspect, if I can be forgiven the aesthetic term, right? That's part of the beauty of the market system, that it is a way of unleashing so much creativity among individuals, not only creativity in inventing new products, but also creativity in devising new forms of organization, right? And it's important to think that, organizational innovation, managerial innovation, entrepreneurial innovation in terms of ownership structure is just as important as technological innovation or product or market innovation. People, the first people to experiment with the joint stock company, Alfred P. Sloan and Pierre DuPont and others who came up with the multi-divisional or M-form structure in the early 20th century, those who first began to popularize, Michael Milken and those who began to use high-yield bonds in new ways, who perfected the technique of the leveraged buyout, firms like KKR that set up large private equity organizations. These are all innovators, right? They came up with organizational rather than technological innovations, but those are extremely important in the economy, and they should be recognized as innovations. So just think how much innovation we would have in a pure market setting. Let me check my email here, see if I've missed any good questions that people might be emailing me at the moment. Okay, Alicia has a question about IP, intellectual property, as a form of government regulation. So my question is, would firms like Disneyland exist in a totally free market? Or how might this change the firm's behavior? Alicia, I take it you mean in the absence of kind of, trademark or brand protection. So if Disney didn't have the right to sue somebody else for copying Disney's products, that's kind of okay. Would it still exist? I mean, that's a great question. I think we can, ultimately, I guess that's an empirical question, right? But we can look at the historical record, and we can look at a lot of different areas, different kinds of so-called intellectual property, the sort of, branding with trademarks and so on, copyright, patent, right? We could look at those issues separately, and we could say, well, the extent to which those things were legally protected and the strength of that legal protection has varied over time and over space, and in fact, even now, right, varies across places. The intellectual property regime in China is very different from what it is in the US, in the EU. My understanding from people who have done those empirical studies is that there are many, many contexts in which there was no legal protection offered for brands, but yet at the same time, branding did tend to be fairly effective, right? And it you think of sort of it's a kind of an informal reputation mechanism, right? So the whole idea of brands, of course, right, is that if I put my mark on something, I go to the grocery store and I buy Kellogg's cereal, right? If it says Kellogg's on it, I can be confident that it won't poison me. Whereas if it doesn't have any brand name on it at all, then I have to worry, how do I know that it's reliable and that it's safe and so on? So the standard argument is, well, if other people can copy the brand without legal penalty, then how does Kellogg's have any interest in putting its mark on its particular thing. But the point is, right, there's kind of a denser network of market-based reputations, right? There's the merchant, for example. So the merchant who operates the grocery store, right, wants customers wants repeat business, right? The proprietor of the store wants me as a customer to have some confidence in the branding in the products that are sold within the store. So the even in the absence of intellectual property law, right, of legal protection for brands, the proprietor of the store has an incentive to make sure that the only boxes that say Kellogg's on them are the ones that really came from Kellogg's. You say, well, but how do I know that the store is reliable? Again, owner of a chain store has an incentive to monitor what goes on in his stores and to make sure that customers know the difference between the stores that stay, Walmart on them and that really are Walmart stores and some fly-by-night non-Walmart operator that has the nerve to put Walmart on the store. I mean, my sense is, and the sense of other people who have studied this, is that it would be much more difficult to copy in that way than we think it would be, right? That you just couldn't build a store and put Walmart on it and fool people into thinking it's really a Walmart unless it really is. It would just be, there are too many aspects of Walmart's business that are secrets known only to Walmart that it would just be too difficult for someone else to copy. Right, you say, well, but wait a minute. What about fake Gucci purses illegal movies or whatever that you can buy from Asia? But look, that's precisely the point. That first of all, it is relatively easy to detect knockoffs, and many people are perfectly happy with the knockoff type product, right? And that it isn't that difficult for people who really care about a Gucci to figure out the difference between a Gucci and a fake. Also keep in mind the role of private third-party certification agencies, right? In the absence of legal protection for patent, copyright, trademark, and so on, there would be incentives for neutral third parties to set up kind of verification services to put their stamp of approval on particular brands and so on, like Underwriters Laboratory, and other organizations that take certifications and so on. So it's if you look at the historical record, Alicia, to give a long answer to your question, it appears that there are many private market mechanisms for entrepreneurs to protect their reputations, even in the absence of government privilege for brand protection. So my sense is entrepreneurs would figure this out without too much difficulty, even if we didn't have IP law. Again, that's a conjecture, but it's supported by kind of theoretical reasoning and also just our experience from history. I mean, there are a lot of studies. If you're really into this literature, you can look at Stefan Casella's blog post, because he has lots and lots of them with lots of links to different articles, empirical historical studies. I just came across one recently looking at pharmaceuticals, comparing. If you look at the Human Genome Project, right, there was the publicly funded government human genome attempt to decode the genome, and then there was the private for-profit Craig Venter's firm that was doing the same thing using a different technology and patenting its gene sequences. And somebody did a study of whether what kind of usable pharmacological, pharmaceutical, health-related innovations have been generated from the genetic, the knowledge of particular gene sequences, trying to see if the gene sequences that were patented ended up generating more innovation than the gene sequences that were unpatented, and found actually that the reverse was true, that the gene sequences that had never been patented were the ones that were generating more usable innovation than the ones that had been patented. And obviously that's one example. It doesn't prove anything in the general case. But my understanding is, if you look at the historical record more broadly, there's kind of an accumulation of evidence that even in the absence of legal protection, there seems to be a lot of innovation, there seems to be a lot of artistic creativity, and there seems to be a lot of company branding. Dean, your point about taking things from the public domain, that's actually a good point. I was just reading this, oh, just yesterday or the day before, someone making the argument that, you know, there's this common belief that copyright protection is all about protecting the artist. But in fact, it's argued it isn't the artists who are making money from copyright anyway. It's that copyright protection rewards those who have the legal monopoly on reproduction. You know, it's the Recording Industry Association and the Motion Picture Industry Association. It's publishers and distributors and so on who make all the money from copyright. It's not the artists. And it's sort of similar to your point about Disney. I mean, Disney has been very successful. There are some original stories, right? But the Disney classics, Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, and so on, come from taking, you know, stories, fables that are already in the public domain and kind of Disneyfying them. Little Mermaid would be another example. I don't know, maybe Beauty and the Beast, as opposed to, you know, maybe DreamWorks and Pixar and so on that have done more original stories. So maybe Disney's not a good example of branding to protect artistic creativity. Although, of course, the production of a Disney movie, whether the original idea comes from the public domain or not, is of course itself a creative act, a heroic act, and so on. I'm all in favor of Disney. Grayson's question about Mickey Mouse. Yeah, absolutely, Grayson. I mean, producing a look, art is entrepreneurial. Right, artists are entrepreneurs. In fact, there's a fascinating set of studies. I've blogged about them. I think I put the link on in a previous lecture. Yeah, I did actually by this guy David Galenson at University of Chicago about different artistic styles. He talks about artists as entrepreneurs. Well, he's talking about different conceptual styles that artists have used that map very easily into the different concepts of entrepreneurship that we looked at. So yeah, I mean, artists operate under conditions of uncertainty. They're experimenting with different combinations of inputs to produce their artistic outputs. And if you can produce a cartoon character that children love and people are willing to pay for, then you have, you know, that's an asset, right? That's a asset that can generate economic value. But again, what related to IP, the idea is what Disney owns is the theme parks, the merchandise that is produced. It owns the physical media of the films and so on. You know, whether it owns the idea of Mickey Mouse is a different thing, right? I mean, that's Kinsella's argument, is that if I took out a sheet of paper and a pencil and I could draw Mickey Mouse, a perfect copy of Mickey Mouse, but I own the paper, I own the pencil, I own my labor, that I haven't violated Disney's property rights. I haven't stolen anything from Disney, because you can't legitimately own an idea. You can only legitimately own, you know, tangible property, property that is scarce and rivalrous and so on. But again, that's a subject for another day. But by the way, there's, you know, speaking of third parties, there's a strong incentive to, you know, for third parties to specialize in tracking down fraud, right? In identifying, you know, shady versus honest and upright entrepreneurs. I think about this sometimes because where I live in Columbia, Missouri, one of my friends in town is an entrepreneur named Ewan Barnett, who is the founder of Carfax. Some of you guys might know Carfax. That's, you know, the website you can go to where you can type in a vehicle identification number. Think about buying a used car, and you can find out, based on insurance records and accident records, whether that car has ever been in an accident, whether it's ever been stolen, and so on. And Ewan founded a company 20 years ago by getting access to some data, proprietary data, from insurance companies and from some local police departments, and using it to construct a database. You know, Carfax essentially is an investigative agency, private for profit, right, that for a fee will look into a used car and tell you what can, you know, what's known about that used car based on publicly available information and so on. You can imagine Carfax type companies for, you know, for other high valued goods and services, where you might want to check: is this thing authentic or is it a copy? Right, and I can guarantee you at the, you know, auctions at Sotheby's or whatever, you know, nobody's going to buy a, you know, 5-carat diamond without being really, really sure that it is in fact a real diamond and not a fake. There's money to be made in providing information on the free market, and certification agencies, presumably there would be a lot more of them, and they would flourish in an environment without legal governmental action along those lines. I think, in fact, you could go further and say that these private certification agencies would probably do a better job of protecting people's original thinking and creativity than IP, the IP regime. Look at the issue of health and safety. There are lots and lots of studies, economic studies, of the effectiveness of, say, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, showing that it's horribly ineffective. Right, and people say, "Oh, but if you didn't have the FDA, then you would have all these dangerous products for sale." But the point is, I mean, there are dangerous products for sale in the grocery store and the drugstore right now because the FDA testing and approval process is so hopelessly bureaucratic and ineffective. And you know, people say, "Well, but why wouldn't private certification firms arise anyway to try to overcome the FDA?" Well, then they do to some extent, but it's very hard for them to make money because consumers are, in a sense, lulled into this false sense of security. That because we have the FDA, people assume that, well, if it's for sale in the grocery store, it must be safe. If you can buy it in a pill bottle, it must be okay. The FDA's approved it. So why would I want to spend money to get somebody else's, you know, to have somebody else test it? Or why would I pay more to get a product that has been certified by the XYZ private testing authority? It's hard to make money under private certification when the population believes that the government is already making everything safe. If there were no FDA, I guarantee you there would be a whole slew of private food and drug testing organizations that would spring up and would compete against each other for reliability and quality and so on. And what we would have would be much, much more effective than what we have now. And I bet there would be far fewer incidences of tainted food, botulism, unhealthy drugs, and so on, than we have today. My point is, I imagine something similar would be true with IP, that, you know, private market mechanisms for verifying identity and protecting reputations and so on would emerge, and would be far more effective than today's court and legislature-based system of protecting identity and creativity, etc. Okay? Yeah, good example, Dean, about construction. You know, the more complicated the production process, the more kind of checks and balances you have, right? The more different parties who have an incentive to make sure that what other parties are doing is, you know, is effective and is compatible and so on. So, you know, I think we tend to grossly underestimate the skill of entrepreneurs and the creativity of the market in being able to come up with solutions for difficult problems. And by the way, you know, as libertarians, we shouldn't fall into the trap of sort of feeling like we have to spell out exactly how this would work. Okay, if we had no IP, legal IP protection, if there were no Food and Drug Administration, exactly what would it look like? How many certification firms would you have? How big would they be? What would they do? Well, I mean, who knows? We don't know for sure, right? Murray Rothbard used to make this great point that advocates of the market should not allow themselves to be put on the defensive in this way. And he says, you know, imagine a society in which, you know, the state had long ago monopolized the production of shoes. There was no private shoe industry, but rather the government was responsible for making and selling all shoes. And then some crazy, libertarian theorist or Austrian economist comes along and says, hey, what if we privatized the shoe industry? What if we let the free market take care of the production of shoes? Right? Well, the immediate reaction would be, are you crazy? I mean, how could the market do that? You think that only rich people should get to have shoes? I mean, how would poor people get their shoes? Right? So, of course, you can quickly see how silly that is, right? But then they would say, well, okay, I'll only go along with your scheme if you can tell me exactly how many shoes would be produced. How many shoe companies would there be? Would they be large or small? What color would the different shoes be? How many different styles of shoes would be offered? I mean, who knows, right? If there had never been a private free market shoe business before, I mean, who could possibly answer all those questions? But the fact that the free market economist in that situation would not be able to specify exactly what the shoe industry would look like is, of course, not any kind of argument at all against, that's not a justification for having the government make shoes. In other words, so the fact that we don't know exactly what what corporate structure would look like in the absence of state regulation, that we don't know exactly how intellectual property would be preserved, we don't know exactly how food and drugs would be inspected, how many organizations would there be, how big would they be, how would they charge their fees, how would they make money, I don't know exactly. But everything we know about the market, everything we know about entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial creativity suggests that we can be pretty confident that entrepreneurs would figure this out and they would do a damn fine job of it. Okay. I feel like I should end my discussion there because of those inspiring words, but we still have 15 minutes left. Yeah, that's right, Grace. If we knew exactly what entrepreneurs would do, then we ourselves would be the entrepreneurs rather than, people sitting around and talking about entrepreneurs. And of course, that's the I get frustrated when I sometimes talk to not only government officials, of course, but even professors too, who are talking about all the mistakes that business people make and how foolish entrepreneurs are. And there's a whole literature in management field about entrepreneurial overconfidence or over-optimism. I had a blog entry at Organizations and Markets on this a couple days ago. The idea that we as scholars or as analysts or students can demonstrate that entrepreneurs are making systematic errors. Okay, well, I mean, then if we know that, then we can make a heck of a lot of money by being entrepreneurs who are not subject to those biases. Okay, so I think we want to be very careful when we go in that direction. I mean, it's our job as analysts to try to make sense of what entrepreneurs do, to try to understand it, to try to make sense of it, to try to think about its implications for society, to try to sort out under what conditions entrepreneurship can flourish. But it isn't our job to tell entrepreneurs what to do, because we're not ourselves entrepreneurs. We're not acting as entrepreneurs when we study entrepreneurship. Okay, I was at a conference recently where some very distinguished entrepreneurship scholars were having this side conversation about venture capitalists. I remember them saying, oh, the VCs are just a bunch of idiots. They don't know what they're doing, and they just squander money. It's kind of an old boys club. It's all about who you know. They don't know how to evaluate investment projects. We're now sitting there thinking, holy smokes. I mean, here you are, a bunch of, underpaid college overeducated professors who nobody listens to and who have who don't have any actual responsibility over real affairs in the world, talking about these VCs who have very large amounts of real resources at stake, who have the responsibility for investing large sums of money, who have a lot of skin in the game themselves, and you're telling me they're all stupid and they're all idiots? I mean, you professor who can barely tie your shoes, how do you know what these VCs should or should not be investing in? Just sort of the hubris, the arrogance of the scholar and the regulator who want to tell tell business people what they're doing wrong is really breathtaking, and I think a certain amount of humility is called for when we study these kinds of things. Not that we worship business people. Roderick Long and Kevin Carson and these kind of left mutualist types. I think, you know, I respect sort of the check they provide against some overly romanticized notions of business. Sometimes you get this from reading Ayn Rand, you know, in her fiction, her descriptions of business people in fiction, and also in some of her nonfiction writing. You know, the big businessman as this kind of romantic hero. Well, I mean, empirically, historically speaking, it's a mixed bag, right? Because big, successful entrepreneurs often are in partnership with the state. In political capitalism, it's not clear that successful entrepreneurs are completely heroic in this way, right? So I don't mean that we should act like that. But at the same time, I think we should have a certain amount of deference and a certain amount of humility in approaching the study of business, and not just assume that we can sit there from our high and mighty lofty perches and tell everybody what they're doing wrong. Yeah, maybe those academics for themselves failed venture capitalists. Could be true. Is Robert Lighton a mainstream economist? I mean, yeah, I guess I would characterize him that way. I mean, I think he's a pretty good mainstream economist. But, yeah, I mean, he's not an Austrian. He's really more of a public policy guy. He has a PhD in economics. He knows a lot of economics, but he really does most of his work as a policy analyst. He's not a professor. He was a research director for the Brookings Institution, you know, quintessential mainstream policy shop in Washington, D.C., and now he works mostly with the Kauffman Foundation. But, yeah, I would characterize him as a mainstream economist in the context of the article that we read. He's certainly not an Austrian when it comes to interpersonal comparisons, cost-benefit analysis. He's using kind of the standard mainstream tools, assuming that you can measure benefits and costs in a way that you can make those kind of comparisons. I mean, I think his stuff is good. Actually, he has a very good book it was published in the 90s on banking called, I think it's called, you know, what do banks do, or what should banks do, or something like that. It's a very, very good overview of, you know, just kind of empirically, a history of bank regulation and history of bank structure and so on. I mean, it's all, you know, pretty good stuff, although told from a fairly mainstream perspective. He also says, in the sense government officials are likely to act as ordinary citizens do it in their everyday lives. Yeah, so ordinary citizens make their decisions based on predominantly political considerations. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think he didn't exactly mean it to come across that way. In fact, he probably thinks that he probably thinks of himself as a government skeptic. You know, relative to the mainstream in which government officials are angels who can do no wrong. I think he probably thinks he's putting it in context. He probably thinks he's saying, look, government officials, you know, there aren't angels. They're making decisions about, you know, what's in their interest, and they're looking at trade-offs and so on the same way that ordinary people do. So we would say, if you start from the perspective that what government officials do is fundamentally and intrinsically corrupt, then you probably think he's being overly soft on them. But Lighton probably thinks that the reader is coming from the point of view that government officials are angels, and he's sort of pointing out, no, they're ordinary people just like you and me. So I guess it kind of depends on how you read it. Depends on your starting point. Okay, Dean, I'm reading your question about MBAs. Let's see. I don't doubt for a minute the stories that you're telling about MBAs. students, although to be fair, I do some MBA teaching myself. But yeah, come on learning what people have learned in MBA programs. I mean, a lot of it's actually true. A lot of, you know, some firms prefer to hire English majors and you know, people who presumably have critical thinking skills rather than who learned a lot of vocationally oriented business schools and then a lot of silly stuff on leadership and so on. So I mean, look, there are tremendous opportunities for academic institutions to improve their product, right? To provide something that's to actually provide a decent return on investment for people going to college. I mean, there are two problems with that, right? One is that the higher education sector, even business schools, is so predominantly affected by and corrupted by state subsidies that universities don't really compete against each other all that aggressively. I mean, U.S. universities compete for students in terms of who can offer the nicest dorms and the fanciest student rec centers and so on. But they don't compete on the basis of curriculum. They don't compete on the basis of knowledge, of offering better instruction, teaching more relevant subjects and so on. Because part of my sense is, because they get so much of their money from the state, even private universities, you know, Princeton or Stanford or Swarthmore College, whatever, you know, if you look at research funding and student tuition, financial aid, and so on, a lot of private schools get a bigger portion of their budget from government sources than state schools. I mean, in fact, so I teach at the University of Missouri, which is a public university, and our university gets something like 40% of its budget from federal and state government sources, and Stanford gets like 70% of its budget from federal and state sources, even though Stanford's a private school and Missouri is a public school. Anyway, the point is almost all in higher education institutions are so dependent on state funding. You know, a school that totally revamped its curriculum and only taught Austrian economics in its economics department and business school and didn't teach, got rid of its women's studies department and critical legal thinking department, and they'd probably lose all their federal funding. And so I think universities aren't competing very aggressively in that area. The other thing to keep in mind is that, even the knowledge that what MBA programs and the other departments are producing is crap, even with that knowledge, some employers still use college degrees as signals. Right? There's a certification effect in addition to the learning effect that goes on in schools. Right? I mean, you can imagine that, suppose there are two types of workers, hard workers and lazy workers, but that potential employers cannot easily tell from interviews and so on whether a given worker is likely to be hardworking or lazy. Suppose that you have colleges, right? And that suppose for a hardworking person or a particularly smart or able person, they can jump through all the hoops associated with college without breaking a sweat. Even though they don't actually learn anything useful, they can take the tests and get good grades just because they're smart. But imagine there's another kind of worker, just because of low ability or because of lazy work habits, just can't pass the classes, can't memorize and regurgitate the crap the professor wants, and therefore find it very costly to try to go through school and decide it just isn't worth it. Right, so in a case like that, employers can use the fact that you have a college degree as a signal that you're a high-ability person, right, rather than a low-ability person, even knowing that you didn't actually learn anything in school. So college degrees, MBA degrees can serve as kind of a signal of quality. My own sense is that, if that's true, there are much more efficient ways to signal quality than this horribly expensive and time-wasting 4 years of undergraduate studies and another year or two for an MBA. I mean, there are much more effective ways to signal. But nonetheless, if to the extent that that's important, then their entrepreneurial opportunities and finding better ways to signal, right? And for universities to convince employers that their degrees have a certain kind of a value, right? Now, I should point out, you know, of course there is innovation in higher education, but it's almost all from outside the regular university system. It's the non-traditional for-profit, you know, it's the University of Phoenix and DeVry University. It's nonprofits like the Mises Academy, for example, right? That's where all the innovation in education is taking place. So when I make this point, some people sometimes complain. They say, "Oh yeah, but you know, the University of Phoenix is no good. A lot of people don't like it, and they got a lot of money from student loans. Their government-funded student loans. Their student loan default rates are very high." Look, I'm not defending the University of Phoenix per se, or claiming that the DeVry University is the best thing since sliced bread, although I would say the Mises Academy is the best, of course, because of the high-quality instruction. But no, my point is simply that, just as we were talking about organizational forms, large firms, small firms, in a free market, we would expect a lot of experimentation and creativity among different types of business entities. Same thing with higher ed. If we had a free market for higher ed, we would expect to see a lot of variety. Large schools, small schools, four-year schools, one-year schools, you know, degree granting, non-degree granting, brick and mortar, online, traditional curriculum, avant-garde curriculum, diversified, specialized. I mean, we ought to see a whole flourishing of different types of higher ed. In fact, you know, today there's basically one model. All four-year colleges are almost exactly the same. If you look at how they do it, what they teach, I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of differences, but compared to all of the different things you can imagine, they're all conformists. You know, I often say that you know, universities have hardly changed at all since, you know, 1150 or something, when students were walking through the leafy quadrangles at the University of Paris or Siena or Oxford or something in medieval eras. The only thing that's changed is we don't wear gowns anymore, okay? But the basic setup of the university, the idea of the curriculum, the way teaching and so on are done, it's hardly changed at all. So higher ed is one of the least innovative sectors, most conservative parts of the whole economy. And if we didn't have the massive state intervention that we have, there would be huge opportunities for entrepreneurial advance. So, okay, guys, it's 10:30. It's time to wrap up. I've got to get ready for some other things here at Mises University. But look forward to staying in touch with you guys over the weekend through email and the forums. And we'll have our class next Tuesday at the usual time, 6 o'clock Eastern. And look forward to seeing you then. We'll do some review and wrap up and get ready to reflect on the good times we've had this semester. Okay? See you guys later.